My guest tonight is Joseph Atwill. He is a researcher and independent scholar. He's the author of Shakespeare's Secret Messiah and the controversial Caesar's Messiah, the Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. His website is postflaviana.org. Joe also is a co-host of a weekly podcast that he does with Jerry Russell, right? Jerry Russell is your...
That's right. Yeah, Revolution Radio, every Monday morning at 12 o'clock Eastern Standard Time.
Yeah, and you also write a lot of stuff with him too, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, that's a fascinating podcast. I highly recommend it. I always make sure I pull down a download a copy of that and listen to it, because you get a whole, I guess you could have an archive there going way back, I guess. At least
that's right. We try to archive all of the podcasts, yeah. and Jerry Russell is, well-informed in areas that are important. He has a background as a clinical psychologist and an electrical engineer, and he was one of the people who worked on big data at the onset when he worked
Nielsen.
So he comes from a very informed place, and a lot of the areas that we get into, I think, are useful for the citizen to be aware of. So
yeah, you two complement each other well in that show. It's good stuff. Thanks. So just want to recommend that podcast. Tonight, I want to talk with you about your research on what's called weaponized anthropology and the creation of the counterculture, as well as the degradation of culture through entertainment and the arts. How do you want to get into that topic?
Right. Well, do you want me to give a summation of how we got here?
Yeah, I want to brief a tour through.
Or do you have a specific question?
Yeah.
Well, the article that is probably a good place for people to start is just called Manufacturing the Deadhead. I wrote this with Jan Erwin in 2014. And it focuses on the Grateful Dead and makes the case that the Grateful Dead was basically part of a effort by military intelligence inside the United States, specifically the CIA, to bring about an archaic revival. When people hear this concept, they find it, almost impossible to imagine. But in fact, if you go through the article, you'll see that we produce primary documents showing that this is exactly the case. And after you've worked through the information, starting with Gregory Bateson in World War II and the development of what is called weaponized anthropology, you then end up in the 50s with this individual, Gordon Wasson. And the beginning of the psychedelic drug movement in the United States is really directly traceable to this individual. You have Huxley and the Doors of Perception, but long before that, and really in terms of, getting into the public mind, it was an article that was on the cover of Life magazine, which referenced this trip to Mexico that Gordon Wasson took, and there he had purportedly this wonderful spiritual experience, and they did Life magazine did an article on it, and then, psychedelic drugs just became more and more something that people were familiar with. And then, of course, 10 years later, you have Woodstock. The important primary document that we bring out in the article is the fact that, it represents that the CIA, specifically MK Ultra, paid Wasson to go to Mexico and to do this research. That everything that Gordon Wasson represented in the Life magazine article is a lie. Everything. Just an absolute hallucination, to use a term. And so when you see this, the question is, well, what was the CIA doing? There doesn't seem to be any, sort of foreign policy area that this is finding out about or affecting. What is the purpose of it? And it goes back, you can then trace back to the origin of the MKUltra project, which is found in a letter that Gregory Bateson wrote during World War II. The letter was discovered by Dr. David Price, who is a terrific researcher into the relationship between the science of anthropology and the U.S. military intelligence, a secret relationship that he has uncovered, and highly recommend his work. But using the Freedom of Information Act, he obtained a letter that was written by Bateson during World War II, which described how a superior people can enslave an inferior people. And I'm not making up these expressions. This is, I'm quoting from Bateson's letter. And I'm just going to digress for a second. Bateson is a very important concept. He's a lifetime actor. Bateson is famous as the husband of Margaret Mead, one of the founders of Esalen. He gave LSD to famous people like Ken Kesey, Allen Ginsberg. And so he's seen as this free-spirited person who's interested in spiritual growth, you know, for people. But actually, when you look at his letters, you can see that he was someone who has a very, very dark and evil moral perspective, who was developing science to enslave the populations, right? This is really what he was doing. And so he determined that, and he actually referenced an experiment that was done by the Russians, incidentally, which is quite shocking. But, you know, if you go to the website, the Post Flaviana website, you'll see an article on Bateson that I wrote, which has the letter and explains that what Bateson and the anthropologist discovered was that if you really want to create a slave state, a stable, functioning slave state, you need to reduce the tension by making the slaves feel that their inferior position is valuable. And to do that, he found the best way was to engender what he called an archaic revival. And that means that they would give praise to the native people when they displayed their ancient traits, the traits from their past. So in other words, this is what the expression, you know, native or archaic revival means. It just means bringing up these elements in the past, the writing, the dancing, the use of drugs, the different cultural aspects that are in the past, and then giving them praise for expressing them. And the reason why this creates less tension in the slave state is that then the technology that the superior people need in order to maintain control, this isn't something that the subjugated people feel jealous about or threatened by, because they are being given praise for embracing their culture, their tradition, right? So when the MKUltra project was developed by the CIA, you know, we don't know much about this project because all of the its records were destroyed illegally by the CIA when they were requested by the U.S. Senate. But we have a few documents, and one of them, of course, is this pay requisition for Gordon Wasson for the trip that began the whole psychedelic movement. And so then, you know, seeing that this was what they were engaged in, you can then move forward and you can connect back to Gregory Bateson. Bateson is at Palo Alto, where MKUltra has one of its centers. And now you can see direct connections into the literature, which helps produce the archaic revival. I'm going to specifically mention Ken Kesey with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which has the, you know, Native American hero at the end and kind of embraces, you know, in an insane world, you have to be crazy in order to get along, you know, this idea. He was an employee of MKUltra, Ken Kesey, who received LSD from Bateson, and also Robert Hunter, who was the lyricist and band member of the Grateful Dead, and so this, you know, is another point of the MKUltra influence of culture. And then if you go into the background of the other Grateful Dead members, you can see there's military intelligence, there's Bohemian Grove, there's a lot of, you know, in hindsight, very clear-cut relationships directly back into military intelligence. And this case, this sort of historical documentation of the background of the original rock idols who are leading the culture into this Native revival. And bear in mind that a lot of them almost all of them are in kind of primitive outfits. If there's a famous picture of David Crosby and his father, it's in the article that is there on the Archaic Revival, Manufacturing the Deadhead. And you can see that David Crosby looks exactly like a member of the Lewis and Clark expedition. And he's sitting next to his father, who looks like, well, he is a, you know, an OSS Annapolis military intelligence individual.
Gray,
you know,
flannel suit and glasses.
Yeah, gray flannel suit. So you can see that, you know, you just have two generations, you know, of military intelligence, basically. And so what really makes the case just overwhelming, and I mean it just becomes absolutely overwhelming, is when you connect that research, the stuff that we show about the Grateful Dead, to what was going on in Los Angeles, because the counterculture really sprang almost overnight in these two areas, where you suddenly have massive amounts of LSD that was available and a kind of folk rock music that was associated with the people producing the music, who had a really a brand new look. I mean, if you think of, you know, the Doors, the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas, the Grateful Dead, I mean, their appearance was dramatically different, you know, than had been seen in America before. And so when you connect what can now be shown about the Grateful Dead to the work that a person named Dave McGowan has done in terms of the Laurel Canyon scene, as he calls it, well, suddenly it just becomes impossible, in my opinion, to not recognize that really the counterculture was a project of the government, and the purpose of it was to bring about an archaic revival. And basically, they would promote a primitive appearance, magical thinking, drug use, sex, you know, without marriage, and kind of a return to nature. They, you know, the if you look at you know, people like Jim Morrison or you know, David Crosby, the individuals making up the Grateful Dead, they had this appearance, and I call it, you know, basically the Lewis and Clark look, which, you know, just occurred overnight. It wasn't something that, you know, slowly developed. They just all of a sudden showed up. And so, you know, what we've been subjected to is basically is an introduction of an archaic revival to the baby boomer. I think the baby boomer was seen as a problem by the oligarchs in that it's a huge demographic bulge of potentially very smart and threatening people to the oligarchs. Had they gone in a different direction politically, who knows what the nation could have become. But, you know, my generation, and I was someone who experienced all of these things, we were hit in two ways, Tim. I mean, we had the Vietnam War on one side, and then we had the counterculture on the other. And that combination just shattered my generation. They, you know, if you look at what political achievements they had, particularly in terms of actual, you know, creating a higher quality of democracy where the oligarchs would share things more efficiently. I mean, we were just, you know, useless, basically. And so, you know, that's the basic thrust of the article Manufacturing the Deadhead. It shows that the project was very longstanding, that what we saw in the 60s in the United States was actually begun far earlier basically at the beginning of the 20th century by a person called Edward Bernays, who was the father of propaganda. Bernays is a weird double nephew of Sigmund Freud, who he had hundreds of letters exchanged with. Only a few are known, but Bernays, you know, began most of the what you can see in the 60s. You can see as quote of the elements of the counterculture. Integration was really something he began, particularly as a tool of the government. Sexualized media. He's almost completely responsible for this. He's one who put on the first edgy play called Damaged Goods with funding from the Rockefellers. You know, many other things, feminism. I mean, all of these things, if you look at the elements that make up the counterculture, and so many of them are these, you know, they have these beneficial, iconic places in our mind, you know, feminism, integration, folk rock music. I mean, you think of these things and you would never imagine them as something that would be a tool of enslavement. But the fact is that, we need, as a people, to become more alert to exactly how culture is formed and by whom, because all of these things can be weaponized, and they were. I guess you listened to a show I did recently on Ms. Magazine, and I pointed out that Ms. Magazine was basically a CIA operation. Another element to break down the family. The feminism that was developed by the CIA was done as part of the archaic revival. The nuclear family, for some reason, I can think of a number of good ones, but I can only speculate in terms of what they were worried about. But it was decided to bring that to an end. And so they produce a number of cultural forces, and one of them was a version of feminism, which was promoted by Bella Osborg and Gloria Steinem, which was really anti-male. And specifically, and in the show I just did recently, I talked about how they went after the black male, because I think the African American was seen as the weakest link and was basically going to be the leading edge of the cultural avalanche into the abyss. They thought they were the weakest, so they went after them the hardest. And this is why the Great Society programs were designed like they were. And it's a really easy thing for people to see the malfeasance, because the demographic statistics of the African-American culture are very well documented from the end of the Civil War up to the beginning of the Great Society programs. And in every single imaginable trait, there was improvement. In other words, they were narrowing the gap in all areas with European Americans. And then the Great Society program began, and in all of these attributes turned negative immediately. And this was because primarily the Great Society programs were designed with this funding of single women that was not given to married women, right? So that single powerful force started to break apart the black society. Now, there were other elements to this, but this was a powerful force. And it began, of course, with the Great Society programs. Now, the Ms. Magazine supported this. Supported the breaking apart of the black family. It created an article, cover article called Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman. And it was a hit piece on the African-American male. And you'd have to, read the article to see just how vicious the characterization of the African-American male is in the article. But it was written purportedly by this black woman, Michelle Wallace, who then later admitted that she had been breastfed. That was the term she used. by this individual, another woman who was operating as an editor for Ms. Magazine. This woman, and her last name escapes me, but she turned out to be the mother of Daniel Pinchbeck, the current proponent of LSD and magical thinking and the, 2012 apocalypse, all of this nonsense. And so, you really get to see a multi-generation malevolence. You get to see, the black male targeted. You get to see middle class whites targeted. And I also reference the work of a gentleman named Daryl Hamamoto. He's a professor at UC Davis. And he pointed out that the Japanese family had been studied during the internment period in World War II, and that a lot of that anthropologic science, which basically was determining how can a family be shattered, was then the basis of what became the Great Society programs, which he intonates was, basically a designed, weaponized piece of political legislation to shatter the family. I just wanted to get back to the point, Tim, that this is obviously malfeasance. I mean, there's just no way this can be anything other than an organized evil inside the government, because all of the statistics turned negative at the time the program began, and they never reworked the program. Even though the statistics were all clearly going south in every category, they never decided to change the structure of the program. So that can't be circumstantial. They have anthropologists that could give them, the meaning of this data if they wanted. And so the, the theory that best explains all this is just that they were getting what they wanted, and so they didn't change.
It was a divide and conquer strategy.
Yeah, well, it was divide and conquer, but it was divide in a particular way. They wanted, what they really were doing was they wanted to create the a moral and intellectual debasement of the African American. That was the idea. And then once they had done that, they would push the white middle class kids into that debased culture.
And they've done that in the past 25, 30 years.
Right. And then you you have the rap music. I mean, look how popular rap music has become. This is obviously a debased, intellectually debased genre. And it's infectious in terms of its influence on white American kids. And so what you're looking at is not history unfolding. I mean, you're just looking at the results of a program.
It's degradation. And if you pointed out that you're accused of being a racist or something, because you
right, exactly, yeah, that it's what they hide behind. But and this is why. See, this is one of the reasons why, when that comes up, which of course is ad hominem, but no problem, maybe we can accept the charge. But you need to start to move it into the primary documents. The documentation of Gordon Wasson being an MKUltra employee exists. The documentation of Gregory Bateson's developing a weaponized anthropology to create an archaic revival exists. Gregory Bateson's relationship with all of these individuals who were moving the culture into this form exists. There is no way that Bateson's relationship with these people can be hidden. It's documented. Gloria Steinem's employment at the CIA is outed. It's completely vetted. She has admitted it.
That's right. It's not a conspiracy theory. She admits
right. These aren't conspiracy. these are the actual. These are the. What platform we have to stand on, in terms of how do we understand this. And so they say, well, we really want to interrupt the argument. We don't want to address any of the facts, but let's go back to the idea that you're a racist or that you're a misogynist. You hate women. Mm-hmm. You don't like feminism. And these are just red herrings. They're trying to push people. They're trying to intimidate people. They're trying to get people to stop, demanding that that there is an explanation and a review, a hearing that's public, that will make sense out of what happened with MKUltra and with the creation of the counterculture.
The biggest obstacle there is just convincing a lot of people know about it, but I would still say it's not generally known.
No, it's not at all. Yeah. I mean, because you see, mainstream media will not vet the concept. But this is why these shows are so powerful. And I just cannot praise you enough. And I told you I was listening to some of your interviews before I came on the show, and I just think they're terrific. And and let me tell you something, that this is starting to cut. It's starting to have some power, because mainstream media is being shunned. People are realizing that it is fake. They can't trust it. And if you look at what it gives as the statistics, they're all in just rapid decline. So I think that Cass Sunstein's statement that, we have to find a way basically to stop conspiracy theories from operating and from becoming popular, because otherwise there won't be a functioning democracy. Well, you have to kind of interpret what he says is to mean that basically the alternative media is starting to get some power, and we have to find a way to destroy it. Otherwise, democracy might exist and the oligarchs won't have control any longer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the interpreted, way to look at what Sunstein, his attack on the First Amendment, what it really means. So, Tim, I tell you, we just have to keep it up and keep pushing harder. And people who hear the information, people who listen to your information, people who read the articles that I've referenced, bring up this information. I tell people, one powerful thing to do is just to get a coffee table and set it up someplace that there is a public forum possible, like a farmer's market or outside a movie theater, and just start getting people to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. Just put the coffee table up, say, hey, look, hey, First Amendment, I'm here to talk about the political reality of the nation, and see who shows up. See what kind of dialogue can be developed, because, in the experience I've had, if you get like five people to start showing up wanting to discuss it, then you are no longer able to be intimidated. Say you want to discuss 9-1-1. You want to discuss the engineering aspects of, the building 7's collapse. Say that's something you want to. Now, if you're there by yourself, you can be easily intimidated, right? People come by, glance at you, but if there's five of you and you've actually discussed it and you all are reasonable people and you have solid information, it's a force. It can't just be with a glance pushed aside. I mean, this is the small steps we have to make to like reestablish democracy in this country, because it's obviously at this point it's just a fake charade whereby we're given a dialectic where we're the Republicans versus the Democrat, but all of the candidates come through the media and none of them represent anything other than the oligarchs.
Yes. Now it's interesting, you mentioned the lifetime actor concept.
Yes, very important for people to get that. Yeah.
Of course, you mentioned Gloria Steinem. Her background is very interesting. She was the recipient of the Chester Bowles Scholarship.
I know. I love that.
Well, that's funny because it was given one time.
Right.
And then, of course, her whole career, she dated Henry Kissinger, this guy Pottinger. He was a Ford and Nixon DOJ official who helped cover up the Martin Luther King assassination. And so she looked at who she hung out with. There's obviously she was not countercultural. She was
right. I mean, she was a mall of the oligarchs. But but the thing is that it was Nation Magazine, I believe, who outed her. And one of the reasons they went after her is because Ms. Magazine put out Black Macho. People were very suspicious of that. Mm-hmm. It didn't seem real to them. They thought it was fake. They wondered about it. They started looking into it. they looked at the Chester Bold scholarship, and then someone found out she was CIA. She denied it at first, and then, at least this is my understanding, and then because they had somehow they got documentation, she went public. And she created this YouTube video, which are not YouTube didn't exist, but she created a video which is available on YouTube.
People can look at it.
And there she says that, you know, the thing to remember is that the CIA was like really this kind of liberal organization that hip, feminist-minded people like myself would be interested in. Now, you know, you have to ask yourself, is there any way that this individual could be so stupid as to believe that? And I just don't think that that lie is plausible, because this was the moment that the CIA was, you know, was engaged in, among other things, and, you know, like things like with the, you know, the Bay of Pigs and whatnot, yeah, with MK Ultra.
Well, Alan Dulles and people like Alan Dulles and Dick Holmes were so progressively minded, right?
Right. Yeah. Just, they couldn't be more. Well, this is the thing, is that if you look at this, the original CIA leaders, they're all banking lawyers, you know, Donovan and Dulles. I mean, there's two other ones. They're just, you know, these are just Wall Street insiders that are obviously representing the financial interests of, in some way. They're not, I mean, what in the heck, you know, Alan Dulles, for heaven's sakes, is absurd. So, you know, her claim that this was this liberal organization that hip people were involved with is ludicrous. And you know, and then in a single isolated position, something like the article could be, well, you know, maybe it was just circumstance, it was just unfortunate, you know, it was a bad idea. But then you look at the Great Society programs and you see the fact that the article supported this, right? It was mm-hmm. it was used as a prop for it. It was a way to turn culture in the favor of breaking apart the black society. And then you look at the other CIA activity to break apart the family, to break apart white families, right? Because you can now see, I think that the case is overwhelming that, you know, the kind of folk rock LSD late 60s scene, both in San Francisco and Laurel Canyon were productions of them. And then and then suddenly the whole picture becomes clear, and you can't really isolate Steinem, you know, in any way that's not malevolent.
You know?
She suddenly we look at her in a context, and the context is very strong. In other words, these are primary documents, right? This is evidence. You just have in conjunction with the primary documents, you have this overwhelming circumstantial case of just way, way too many of these people are involved with military intelligence, you know, like Jim Morrison's father being the admiral who was in charge of the Gulf of Tonkin false flag.
Frank Zappa's father, Edgar
Zappa's father was involved in chemical warfare and LSD, you know, is another thing. So, you know, suddenly the circumstantial case, you know, becomes supportive of the primary documents and vice versa. And it just, I mean, if this was a court of law, there would just be a guilty verdict almost immediately. It just, you just can't get around it. So this is a real problem for us, because it means that there is malfeasance, that inside the government, there is a deep state that has power, right? I mean, it's never been outed. Obviously it is in control, because if it wasn't, there would have been some exposure to something like the, you know, as destructive to the citizenry as the Great Society programs and the counterculture for you know, the European American kids in the 60s and 70s. This stuff has never been brought out, and so you can see that this organization has control and resists any kind of democratic you know, opposition. And so we have to look at our nation in a different way. We have to look at it as basically under the control of a group that has gotten the apparatus of power, financial power, military power, political power, and is using it against the citizens.
That's how they control the culture, because in the same way that Edward Bernays organized the Liberty Torches in the 20s,
right?
When feminism was kicking in, all of a sudden Madison Avenue, Hollywood, TV, everything kicks in.
Exactly.
And
so it's all part of a enslavement process.
The same with the teenager, because in Hollywood, when they created the teenager, was a creation of Hollywood and advertising. I mean, the concept of the teenager being separate, you know, from adults and kids, where when they, you know, Rebel Without a Cause, and those movies came out with a certain
agenda. Just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And then you know, like I have articles there on Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, where you, I was getting it. Yeah, Catcher in the Rye, how it's supposed to
be. Yeah, this comes out of nowhere. It has this very intense first-person narrative.
And that's 1951.
Right, 1951, and he was working on it, Salinger was working on it during World War II while he was a member of the OSS, when he was in military intelligence. Can't prove it, but the claim is that he actually was working with Henry Kissinger. He was doing interrogation of French and German prisoners, but he was also, again, this is just speculation, but there is evidence, some evidence that he was involved in Operation Paperclip, which ends up as basically one of the things that brings about at the MK Ultra project.
Yeah, one of the big
So Salinger wrote this weird book. You know, and it has this, it's very, very easy for young people to identify with Holden Caulfield. He seems, you know, like his angst is really something that people can relate to, and it's written in that way. And it just on the surface is very destructive because he's an alcoholic. He, you know, smokes cigarettes. He's kind of very risque sexually. He's insane. So not exactly someone you want as a role model, but somehow the book becomes very, very popular. And the two things that I show in the analysis of the book is that the book has a not particularly veiled homage to Freemasonry inside it. I mean, he starts out, he fails the test, Holden fails the test studying the Egyptians that he had 28 days to study for. And 28 days is the period of time from the, you know, when someone joins Freemasonry until you have the first initiation of the Egyptians, you know, this ancient culture so much. But I mean, that's pretty well, you know, that could be circumstance. But then you get into things like Holden starts talking about sleeping in Eli's bed, and the phrase is repeated four times. And sleeping in Eli's bed is basically describing one of the levels of Freemasonry. It has to do with the Book of Samuel. I won't go into the stuff because it's really kind of weird and stupid. But the whole book is structured around basically a kind of a hidden way of representing the fact that Holden is going through a Freemason, basically up the level kind of a situation. And then there's this very troubling kind of subliminal pederast relationship that he has with his sister. And I wrote an article with Dr. Jerry Russell, the co-host of the show I do in Revolution Radio. And you know, he agreed with me that this is what's called neuro-linguistic programming. In other words, they're trying to promote pedophilia in the reader, the sex with very young people. And so if you look at the analysis, I think it's, you know, very solid, and I don't think a reasonable person would dispute it now that it is basically out and people can... In fact, I've been advocating that people go to their school boards and demand that the book be taken off the mandatory reading list, because it's a weapon. The thing is part of the archaic revival. It's part of what they were thinking about doing to the American culture post World War II to reduce it in terms of its political capacity. In terms of any kind of political power that the population might have had, they had in mind to take them into a primitive state, into a state where without family, without extended family, without ethnic pride, without all of the things that might unify the people against the oligarchs.
And that was occurring in the cities too, with urban renewal and the destruction of the urban neighborhood and the creation of suburbia factored into that.
Yeah. So anyway, so you had, you know, cultural shapers who were malevolent that used weaponized anthropology, weaponized media, to take us into this place we are now, where every attribute of democracy is being diminished.
And the weaponized part of the weaponized anthropology is entertainment and media, and that couldn't have been achieved until people were dispersed into suburbia, where they lose their ethnic, religious identities, right? The opposition to this stuff, particularly with the Catholic Church in Hollywood.
It would have been very difficult. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So what they did was...
Because you had the production code, which was part of the church flexing its muscle. And then
The Catholic Church had a tremendous influence on Hollywood. It had this rating list that was actually something that Hollywood paid attention to, because they were promoting moral behavior and they actually were able to expose Hollywood as evil. They had a rating that was called Condemned or X.
Yeah.
And if you got that rating, the film was dead. Mm-hmm. It had no financial future whatsoever. And so now in the post-suburban era, where all of this has kind of evaporated and divided and conquered, then it just... You said this, very slowly. Culture moves like, a giant ocean liner. It's slow. But they were able to turn it in a bad direction, and then you end up finally with things like Miley Cyrus, and she's an important lifetime actor to understand, because if you look at the first iteration of her personas, Hannah Montana. A young, beneficial, positive young girl who has an alter ego as a rock star, right? So the young people, very young children, girls, are watching the show and identifying with her. They become, something she is something that they're influenced by. Nothing seems wrong. This is, she's just an idol to young people, but because, it's a Disney production, people don't worry about it too much. But then overnight she becomes the Whore of Babylon. Right. And now these very young girls who she's able to influence, and she has this conditioned structure of influence over, they are being taken into the most debased sexual and moral position that's even imaginable. Mm. Right. She's promoting, there's just nothing that is, beyond her her current persona. So this isn't circumstance, right? She was, she is a weapon. She was created, and the first iteration was part of the attack, and the second phase is delivering the blow. And so, the Miley Cyrus is really just a microcosm of really what's happened to us. The first, if you look at Edward Bernays and how he begins feminism and integration, the music idols, sexualized media, it's always very gentle, very, it's under the banner of liberation, getting rid of inappropriate and kind of square and traditions. And then it slowly moves into, the 60s, and you have Woodstock, and then it ends up with Miley Cyrus and rap music, right? And these are all cultural points for young people to be influenced by. And, at the same time, you're having the financial system basically is becoming just more and more a system of enslavement, right? And, you now have, in the 50s, a regular person could have a male could have a regular job and have a wife and children. The wife wouldn't have to work. And now today that's just impossible.
Yeah. He had a job to support his family, had the admiration of his family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So respect. And so yet this has occurred in a period of time where there has been greater technical progress than has ever been made in mankind's history. How is it possible that none of this has benefited the citizen whatsoever. And in fact, the citizen, by every reasonable standard, has retrograded during that period. This can't be circumstance. I mean, this can only occur if, believe me, if there was no constant structure and manipulation of culture to debase financially and morally the citizens, you know, just the power of the technical improvements would have meant that life would have been just much, much better. Mm-hmm. So really we're, you know, we're in a system that is being developed to, you know, first debase, then enslave, and then finally genocide us.
And it could, part of it also could be a soft genocide, at least at one stage, because what you also have in all this is just the is birth rates.
Right. Well, we're being assaulted in every way. I mean, there is chemicals in our body which are reducing sperm count dramatically. I mean, if you look at the European male sperm count, it's just off a cliff. The Japanese, same thing. You look at family production, just isn't happening. There's not children in the families that do exist. And then, you know, you're now looking at enforced vaccinations and the glyphosate.
Yeah.
In all food, all GMO food. I mean, these things are just, there is no way they can be defended. They are destructive. And yet it's virtually, you know, the media is promoting them at every turn. So, you know, there are hopeful signs. You know, I think just as an example, a quiet revolution is going on with organic food because, you know, more and more people are realizing that the stuff that that mainstream, you know, food production individuals are, you know, it's poison. You can't go to McDonald's. I mean, that stuff is poison, and it tastes good, but you're going to be sick and weak and fat, you know, if you eat this stuff. And so it's, you know, people are turning away from it to the extent they can, you know. And so this is an area, you know, another great area of revolution is to, you know, all of the small gardens that are occurring and the small organic farmers that are occurring. I mean, this is in a response to the malfeasance between big agriculture and, you know, and the government. And it's also happening in terms of vaccinations and the drugs. I think that a lot of people are realizing that the meds are not beneficial. You know, they come, if you trace them back, they come right out of MK Ultra, typically, you know, things like Ritalin and Prozac. I mean, you're not dealing with a nice trajectory. The big pharma is something that really needs for the public to, you know, to understand the moral perspective of. Mm-hmm. You know, in vaccinations, you know, it's another thing. There's starting to be a resistance against this. Because think about how powerful this is. You know, the mandatory vaccinations now for the public schools. I mean, if there is malfeasance in the government, you know, they once they have this legal ability to put things into your body whenever they choose to, you know, how dumbed down can they make your children?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this is the, you know, you can see the area, the kind of the battlefields are starting to become clear, and a lot of people are, and thanks to you and shows like yours are starting to make the turn. They're starting to realize that these are battlefields, you know, and I would even say so far as like the information that the mainstream media is giving to prop up the foreign policies, you know, all of these wars in the Middle East. You know, the latest Arab terrorist boogeyman, this ISIS organization. I mean, there's really starting to be a resistance to the mainstream's explanation as to where the organization came from, as to how it's funded, as to why we don't stop it, you know. So, you know, things are in process, and hopefully as the new media has more power, as more of this documentation gets out, I think there'll be more and more people that are willing to, you know, to actually actively resist. And so I would hope that the article we referenced earlier, that Manufacturing the Deadhead, be read by people who listen to this, because You know, it contains primary documents that show absolute malfeasance on the part of the government. The other article on Gregory Bateson showing the letters obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. I mean, these are sort of the foundation of, you know, a clear-minded citizen. You know, you get to see these actual fingerprints of malfeasance of some organization inside the government that is deep state, that it never leaves. It's always there. It doesn't matter who's in office. It's in power. And so, you know, this is the information we need to have to try to create an effective democracy. Is we need to know that the deep state, whatever it is, it does exist. And we have to resist it. And that's why I think, you know, before the show, we were talking about things to do. And I really recommend getting DNA testing of all the oligarchs right across the board. We have to know the ethnic and family backgrounds of every one of these individuals, because we want to know what we're voting for one thing. You see, if the Bush family are just an offshoot of the Rothschilds or of the Rockefellers, right?
Or Aleister Crowley.
Or Aleister Crowley. But you see, this is why it's so important.
Yeah.
Because these rumors swirl around and, you know, you don't know how to verify them, but we can. Mm-hmm. We need to create a citizens' DNA database of the oligarchs, financial oligarchs, media oligarchs, and political oligarchs. And then we have to compare them, because in that way we'll know what we're getting. We'll know, you know, what is the real background of the secret society, who's in it and who isn't, and what we're voting for. Mm-hmm. So this is something that can be done. Now, I think that they are anticipating this, the oligarchs, because I've noticed that, you know, like, for example, Madonna travels now with a DNA cleanup crew. You know, and I think, and she's someone I'd really like to find out her ethnic background and her family background, for example.
Because why was she so successful? I mean,
exactly.
It's hard to look at her music and go, oh, that's good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, where in the heck do these people come from? How do they, out of all the thousands of people who, yeah. I mean, people who are, you know, obviously more talented or better looking or whatever, they don't get anywhere. And yet somehow she is this, you know, 30-year icon, you know, Rolling Stones. You know, I mean, Keith Richard, he has a biography which shows him manifesting the one eye, mm-hmm. Aldous Huxley. And, of course, he wears the skull and bone ring. I saw a documentary about him where he had the Deadhead symbol, you know, on his guitar. You know, these are troubling symbols. All of these as a package. You know.
You did an interesting take of getting into the music, the idea of weaponized entertainment. And, you know, just Dave McGowan did the thing, his research on Laurel Canyon. And right. Others have also done research on the rock scene. Jan Irvin's done a lot on that. There's also Alex Constantine.
Yes.
And does some good research on the music scene. It's corrupt nature. The fact is all mobbed up, connected to intelligence. And once you realize that, some of these other things aren't too outlandish to accept. Okay, we have Laurel Canyon. The idea, you promote the folk rock scene, psychedelic music. That's from a political standpoint, it's a strategy of tension. It upsets the middle class, divides the generations. It also marginalizes the anti-war movement, because prior to that it was kind of clean cut, academic, respectful, and all of a sudden hippies come on the scene and all the Archie Bunkers react, right? So you have this, you know, reaction. It polarizes.
Right.
And so that's... And
basically, yeah, the society is getting torn apart. A political response by the citizen is almost impossible because we're fighting one another.
Yeah, and those who want to respect decent society, I mean, if your daughter's trying to run off to a rock festival, she can get raped in the mud or can take drugs or whatever, you're going to react a certain way to that sort of side, that side. You're going to choose your side. And as a part of respecting, as a part of defending respectful society, you're going to support the police, support the Pentagon, support the Vietnam War, support the state.
You got it, brother. I mean, this is exactly right.
Yeah, it's a strategy of tension.
They set up an artificial dialectic because this, I mean, the gladiatorial pit. You know, I've been talking, I know we want to talk about the Beatles, but I mean, I want to, like Europe recently have had this enormous influx of Muslims. Mm-hmm. Right? They've had this enormous influx, and no one understands it. They go, what in the heck is going on? There's millions of these people being brought in. Why? And my answer is, well, they're turning Europe into a gladiatorial pit. They're going to have the European and the Muslims battle one another. Mm-hmm. And they will, you know, initiate that with a series of, you know, horrible false flags. They'll collapse a financial structure. There'll be very little food. And then they'll let these people just fight it out.
Yep. And they're all blaming each other. There's a Kelly Greenhill wrote a book called Weapons of Mass Migration.
Yeah,
and it lays out the strategy. It's not even written critically. She's just pointing out as an effective strategy for statecraft or geopolitics.
Right, exactly. and when you couple that with the statecraft, the technical expertise with malevolence, mm-hmm. when you have a deep state secret society that controls the apparatus of government, now you have real trouble for the citizen. Because now the immigration is being done in a way to basically to create this gladiatorial pit.
Yeah, and of course the immigration itself isn't natural. It's born out of all these wars that are conjured up, right? You wouldn't have this problem.
Of course. Well, in my opinion, there's no way there would even this group of Muslims would even come into Europe at this time without basically being brought there by the government, mm-hmm. by the EU government, because they wouldn't have both the legal capacity to make this move, nor the financial or physical. And how would they do it? So something is going on that's sick. And my explanation is that you're having all of Europe is going to be turned into a gladiatorial pit, because I do think we're at risk of the financial system collapsing. And when it does collapse, you'll have martial law, but you'll also have, you know, desperate people with not enough food. And then if you have these ethnic scapegoats, mm-hmm. and with particularly when each side thinks the other one is, you know, the problem, well, then you've just got a really wonderful spectacle for the oligarchs, don't you?
Yeah, because what you have on one side, you have, of course, you know, the immigrants, the migrants, or the, say, whatever ethnic group, and you have the reaction to it. In the United States, we have this developing white identity movement, a white nationalist movement.
They want the whites and the blacks to kill each other.
Yeah, and so now you have this reaction, and I think Michael Jones made a point, we're talking about this, and he says what matters really is ethnicity, not race. But he says, his point is, the problem is whenever you have a situation like this, you make the mistake of attacking your immediate enemy, as opposed to putting your attention on who's pulling the strings.
Well, this shows you that it's like you're looking at integration, and you defend it in all of these ways, and it makes perfect sense in all of this from a certain perspective. But the question really has to be asked: can it be weaponized? You see. Because the question is not whether or not it's beneficial. One can imagine all kinds of ways it's beneficial. But the question has to be asked, can it be weaponized? Can the oligarchs go, aha, let's see if we can use what is, under many circumstances, a good moral and beneficial kind of process, but we can take that process and use it as a weapon, mm-hmm. use it in a way that it's destructive. Use it as feminism was used to help bring down the family. Use it as how integration was done to bring down the dangerous ethnic cohesion of European Americans. I mean, these are the questions you have to ask before you act. You know, is mm-hmm. what am I really being propelled by? What is really in back of all this? And once you start understanding that the counterculture was weaponized anthropology, believe me, the rest of the world is going to make a lot more sense.
Well, this is why important understanding the existence and the influence of secret societies, because there are organizations that are wonderfully funded that think in terms of decades, centuries, and generations. They're three-dimensional chess players, and they have malfeasance on the mind, and they think they have the right to experiment with humanity, and they have the resources and power to do just that. And the problem is most people have a hard time entertaining that such malevolence can exist and be so well organized and hidden.
Right, exactly. And, yeah. And they're just absolute experts at staying hidden. You look at the Beatles, for example, and you look at the cover of Sgt. Pepper's. Well, first of all, with the Beatles, you've had a kind of Miley Cyrus phenomenon already, because they start out as these, you know, lovable mop tops singing "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and then you end up, you know, in '67 with, "Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds," an homage to LSD. I mean, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how did that happen? How did all of these elements of culture work in this direction in exactly the right time and way to produce basically what we saw at Woodstock?
At the same time, they're producing the same thing with integration. It's the same tactic here.
Exactly right.
We're talking peace and love. How can you be against us? It's great.
And of course, rhythm and blues music.
Which is irresistible.
African American influence music, mm-hmm. which is helping to promote integration, but the music itself probably has a kind of mental effect, which they wanted. It's something that distracts from critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you think about in my generation, I mean, they would listen to, you know, these albums and smoke marijuana days on end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was just beyond belief how overwhelmed we were by the music and the drugs.
Wasn't jazz also promoted for that very reason too?
Sure, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think that jazz and rhythm and blues were, you know, basically in back of what's then the folk rock scene, and then you move forward into basically end up in Woodstock.
And doesn't rock and roll mean fornication?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so it's, these things are all, you know, ideas that are being, you know, programmed into young people.
Mm-hmm.
The middle class family is square. It's not hip. There's something wrong with it. Kind of more freedom of sexuality, less family production. And of course, this is exactly when birth control is available, right?
And who was behind that?
Right. And then if you trace that back, you can see again, it's just nothing but the oligarchs. I mean, even the pill was, something that Aldous Huxley, he invented the term, you know, so that. So you can see it has this kind of Brave New World element from the very start. And so, you know, with the Beatles, so you start out as the lovable mop tops and you end up with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And you also have this interesting song, I Am the Walrus. I think the analysis that I do of it shows that basically it's just an homage to Freemasonry.
It's not nonsense.
Right.
The lyrics are not nonsense. I know
it's not gibberish. I mean, this is the thing, is that I am you, you are he, we are all together. That's actually a quote from a song that the Boers sang as they were being chased by the Freemason British Army to Pretoria. Lennon uses it. And then just to show how the song operates, because it's just so sick, he then, you know, says, "See how they run like pigs from a gun. See how they fly." Well, this is an obvious pun on Boer, right? See how they run like pigs from a gun. See how they run like boars from a gun. I am you, you are me, we are all together. This is a direct quote from the song that the Boers sang to try to keep their spirits up while the Freemason British Army was swirling around them trying to execute them. And in fact, all of these people end up in Camp Irene, which is the first concentration camp, which was pointed out as just evil beyond imagine, because this was, you know, where women and children were starved to death. Anyway, so I am you, you are me, we are all together. See how they run like pigs from a gun. And the walrus, I am the walrus, and I'm crying, these Lennon's, you know, howling kind of, you know. I mean, That comes from The Walrus and the Carpenter by Lewis Carroll, the Freemason. And in that poem, The Walrus and the Carpenter fool a generation of young people. They're called oysters, but they have legs, so you can see it's not very metaphysical. It's a young generation. They're called the youth. And then they kill them all. And the reason they're crying is because there's no one left to destroy. That's why they're crying. That's what when Lenin is saying, "I'm crying," he's using the refrain from Walrus and the Carpenter. The tears were shed because the young generation had been completely destroyed and there's no one else to kill. And so this is the Freemason perspective that Lenin is paying homage to. And then just, I won't go into all of the details, but another one is, just to show pretty much how easy it is to decode, there are the lines, waiting for the sun to come. If the sun don't come, you get your tan, standing in the English rain, right? Well, this is making fun of the what's called the Easter Rising, where on Easter Day the Irish rebelled against the Freemason British control, and it was in a sports stadium. They were waiting for the sun to come. It was Easter Sunday. You see, the rising up of Jesus is the sun. Now you get your tan, this is the black and tan. This is the British Freemason special ops group. You get your tan standing in the English rain. This was the battle. It's not a battle, it's a slaughter. But this was the time when automatic weapons were used on civilians for the first time. So, sitting in an English garden because they considered Ireland theirs, waiting for the sun to come. This is the people who are, waiting for Jesus. Basically, it's Easter Sunday. They're in this religious event. If the sun don't come, this is a wry comment on Christianity. You'll get your tan standing in English rain. Well, that's pretty easy to understand. They just the tan gave them the English rain. So you can see that, when you place all of the concepts together, the last one is a little cryptic, but it's actually part of a theme. And that helps, clarify the symbolism. Why Aleister Crowley's on the cover of Sergeant Pepper, and why all of they have so many Freemasons on the cover, it's just beyond belief. So you can see that this is an homage to Freemasonry. This is what's producing the Beatles. This is what is producing the counterculture.
And there's also the original album cover for Yesterday and Today with the slaughtered babies.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So you can see that they have this perspective in the inner circle of genocide, and they maintain this tone, this moral tone, by training. All of these people had to have been trained. Because they would have known, people like Jim Morrison and these individuals would have known that the drug use that they were going to promote with their roles of lifetime actors, because that's what they are. They're lifetime actors. They're people whose whole persona is just a fake. It's an act that is part of weaponized anthropology against the public. They would have known that they were going to take people not just to a debased place, but they were, in my generation, think of all the people who got killed or were mentally damaged by drug use. Mm-hmm. Right. So in order to participate as a lifetime actor, someone like Gordon Wasson or Gregory Bateson or any of these rock and roll stars who were obviously, trained for the roles. If you look at Dave McGowan's work, he shows that none of them could even play instruments or sing, when they showed up as fully formed rock stars.
Yeah, they had the wrecking crew with them.
They had some other band, handling all of the actual creation of the song. But to take the role on, to take the role of this lifetime rock and roll actor, where they're pretending to be something they're not, they had to have this accepting of genocide. Mm-hmm. You see, so when you look at like Gordon Wasson, who wrote this article in Life magazine. Okay, now the article is clearly a lie. I mean, this is a guy who's under the employment of MK Ultra, right? Nowhere in the article does he mention this. And so you can see that it's completely a lie. Now, Gordon Wasson, he isn't someone off of the street. He was a partner of J.P. Morgan Bank, which of course is, you know, where the Federal Reserve is created. And he was suggested at a short list of three or four people to be the head of the Federal Reserve. Now, beyond this, Jan Irwin has actually got primary documents, real actual documents, showing that Wasson was the chairman of meetings of the Council of Foreign Relations, right? So now it's completely clear the level that the secret society operates at. It's right at the top. It's right inside the Council of Foreign Relations. It's right inside the Federal Reserve. It's right inside the banking families. You see, Wasson is such a great place to start because he reveals all of this. It all becomes perfectly clear.
And of course, Life magazine is part of Henry Luce's Time Life.
And right. And now with Luce, you're at Skull and Bones, yeah. Which is just a high level Freemason, kind of secret society. But these are not eating societies. It isn't a dinner, soiree where they, discuss their wealth and the fun at polo meets. I mean, they're talking genocide, Tim. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what is really going on there. They're talking about how to get millions and millions of people off the planet so that they and their little tribe can have dominion. So this is really what we're up against. And it's when you realize how vast the society is, how well organized, we are really, in a very difficult moment, and the citizen really needs to rally immediately, to organize immediately, because believe me, they haven't developed the surveillance state. The vaccination technology. I mean, they're not doing this for no purpose. They really do intend to get the population reduced dramatically. And so, people need to, recognize the world they live in for what it is and take steps to try to improve the quality of our democracy, which frankly won't be too hard to do because at the moment it's basically non-existent. Mm-hmm.
The biggest obstacle, again, there is getting people to, well, one thing is pay attention and to start doing their own research and thinking about.
Well, but I'll tell you, I just think that as long as the internet is up, we have a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. Because information can be exchanged so rapidly now. And there is a advance guard developing of people who are like listening to your shows. Mm-hmm. This, there are not a few, there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people now that are at different levels of suspicion about the circumstance of our political reality. Mm-hmm. And so this group can basically continue to grow and continue to organize and continue to learn how to use social media so that it can grow faster and faster. I go into Costco 5 years ago, there were no organic products for sale. None. Today, there's probably 30% of the food that's sold there is under a green label of organic. That's a direct reflection of a very rapidly growing awareness against a dangerous element, against the citizen. So if that can happen there, you see, we can actually start to have a political revolution. And, those that listen to our talk, who look at the research, feel that they agree with it. The power of the coffee table just get a coffee table, find a public forum, like a farmers markets are great places to do this, and then just set it up and just say, First Amendment, I'm here to talk. I want to talk about the political reality we're experiencing because, frankly, it scares me. And I want more people to be aware of it. We should have coffee tables at every farmer's market, at every mall, outside every sporting event, outside every political convention, outside any time the banking class gets together for you know, one of their fests, there should be the coffee table. You know, we should just always be there asking that people listen to an alternative explanation for our reality.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were you mentioned the Lennon, the Beatles and John Lennon, and yeah. Those lyrics suggest that Mr. Lennon did not write that song on his own.
Oh, I don't think he could have. I mean, he would have been very difficult for him to have had all that information. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's like his. I mean, the song "Marching to Pretoria" was almost unknown except by, you know, specialists in the Boer War.
Yeah, yeah. So
and why would he? So you know, no. I mean, I would think the odds of him having written it are like one in a million.
Which suggests something about the Beatles themselves as an enterprise. That much of Beatlemania we now know was prefabricated, which isn't too difficult to understand. It's entertainment, and promoters are going to pay girls to come out and scream, and then it takes on a life of its own. And their music was, you know, their music catalog is very good. The music itself was very good. It has stood the test of time, and I think it's much, you know, that era produced great music. That's part of how they suck people in. Yeah. I think music since then has been continually dumbed down for another reason. But is there any connection of the Beatles to like Tavistock and the same way that the some of these rock bands in Lower Canada were connected to intelligence?
Well, the there is. It's I'm actually doing that research right now.
Oh, okay.
And I'll send you an article on it. But absolutely, the Beatles and Tavistock are connected.
And Tavistock again is?
Well, the Tavistock Institute for Human Behavior, basically it's the CIA MKUltra of British military intelligence.
Okay, so that's okay.
And the you know, like a real simple way for people to understand this relationship between the Gregory Bateson's MKUltra in Palo Alto and the Tavistock Institute and the Beatles, you know, going on. Look at who the actual manager was for the Grateful Dead, a guy named Alan Trist, and he is the son of the founder of the Tavistock Institute.
That's interesting. So, yeah.
So you know, these are not connections that are possible to be circumstantial. You know, you have you know, on both sides of the ocean, you have, you know, these influences affecting these seminal bands. Because remember, the Grateful Dead are actually beginning, they're in so many ways, you know, they are ground zero for the LSD culture in America, just like the Beatles are the ground zero for the LSD culture in Britain. I would even say, you know, the song Penny Lane is what would be called a typology. In other words, it's an homage to the connection between, you know, the Tavistock and MKUltra, because, you know, you have on, you know, it's a, you know, Penny Lane, you know, it's he's talking about Liverpool, and then it transitions and it says Penny Lane, you know, under blue suburban skies. Well, that's not Liverpool, mm-hmm. I guarantee you. What is he talking about? And this is because where the Grateful Dead were headquartered with Alan Trist and Ken Kesey and the members of the Grateful Dead was on Perry Lane, which is in Palo Alto. And
yeah.
Is where the MK Ultra, you know, employees were. And so you have, you know, and then he has, she feels as she's in a play. She is anyway, you know, selling poppies. I mean,
yeah,
that, I think
nurse,
that's,
yeah.
Well, but that's actually probably talking about Ken Kesey. And Cuckoo's Nest and the, you know, the narcotics that were being given to people who are crazy is, you know, it's just a, you know, it's just a good idea to do this. It promotes drug use, and it's an homage to the MKUltra project in the United States. So, you know, so the Beatles have, you know, they have wonderful simple lyrics, but whenever they have kind of cryptic symbolism, it's very often the case you can kind of make sense of it as malevolent Freemason inner jokes, you know, and Aleister Crowley type stuff, basically.
Now, the standard, okay, is it Michael Hollingshead is the one that gave LSD to the Beatles? Do you have that name right?
Well, you know, different stories about that.
Yeah. Mm. He was intelligence, from what I understand. So.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard that. I heard a story that it was a dentist also. They have different ways of talking about it. I actually have another belief about that. I don't think they took LSD at all. I don't think that Jim Morrison took LSD every day.
Yeah, it could be just a, yeah.
I mean, I think that these were media stories that were planted to, because these were influencers. They were people who were to influence young people. But I think they knew how dangerous the drugs were, and they wouldn't have taken them, frankly. I think it's very unlikely. I really don't believe it. I mean, it's possible.
I've heard the same thing about celebrity cancer diagnosis.
Well, yeah, there you go.
It's like, and they live. Of course, everyone else I know dies from them, but of course, they live.
Yeah. Terrence McKenna, who advocated what he called a heroic dose of some absurd psychedelic, maybe it was MDT or something. I forget. I don't use those things. But so he advocated what he called the heroic dose. You know, you've got to really get yourself out into spaceland to experience the full benefit of this drug. His brother outed him as saying, no, he never took drugs. He said, no, he didn't take drugs. You know, see, so this is...
wasn't that the same thing with Charles Manson?
Yeah. I mean, so the thing is that, you know, you have the media, you have a story, you have the cultural influence. This is all different than reality. Who knows what the reality is? I don't believe... I mean, once you break into the Beatles as a Freemason military intelligence op, there's nothing really left to believe in. You know, you don't know who these people are. What they are is lifetime actors. You know, it's an act.
Yeah.
That's what the reality is. So
also when you get into Lennon's assassination,
very suspicious. You know,
they catch on the rye and all that stuff. So,
well, that's exactly right. Yeah. And so, you know, it's a sad thing, but basically once you start getting an understanding of the lifetime actor, you know, how powerful that tool has been to influence culture and how it's been used by the secret society for hundreds of years, what we have as history just about disappears.
Mm-hmm.
There just really isn't anything you can trust. I mean, I don't believe for a second that there were any real reasons for World War I or the Civil War. I mean, these were population-reducing operations. They have a cover story, which we claim is history, or is given as history. But who knows what the reality is? There's nothing you can trust, nothing you can really vet, because, you see, they had control over the facts, or what we see as the facts, right? And so since they've controlled the literature and the history and the media, we just are in the dark. I mean, what we have is our senses, our reason, and our self-interest. And we know they exist. We know that there is a secret society. And we know that we need to put sunlight onto it. I mean, these are the bedrocks, right? There is a secret society. It does control Western culture. It is malfeasance. It is dangerous. It wants population reduction. And so what we have is the truth is self-interest. You know, we want to put sunlight on it. We want to know what it is, who it is. We need DNA evidence about it. We need to have whistleblowers who are inside to start coming forward and giving us more and more understanding of it. And we need it fast because you know, the internet gives us this first time in history power to organize ourselves. But the oligarch sees this and is also developing technology to promote his interests, its interests. So we've got to act quickly.
Yes, very true. That's fair. You know, well, I mean, it is. It's just one thing. It is. I've come to a lot of stuff gradually over the years, so I never quite had a cold slap in the face about anything, other than maybe some events like 9/11 and coming to understand or acknowledge some of the anomalies of that day and what the implications were. That's a big thing right there. A lot of these, what you said about it is we don't know our history because we have to revise everything we thought was true.
Right.
And that is a tall order for most people.
It's impossible, and yeah. I don't think it can be done. I mean, it's not a reasonable hope. I mean, what we can do is to, you know, there isn't enough data available. What we can do is just demand over and over and over again to have more sunlight. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to know more and more. And whoever finds out information, if you find out information about Hillary Clinton, what is her ethnic background? Who are her family related to? What, you know, Bill Clinton, the Bush family. Then that information needs to be shared. You see, that's what we need to do is we need to start vetting the oligarchs in every way we can and sharing this understanding. Because it's like you said, like 9/11, you know, was just preposterous, right? It was preposterous, the story that was told. But they could get away with it because they had control over the media.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was the what really crashed on 9/11 was the belief that the media was independent. That was what was destroyed. That was what hit the tower. Was there any possibility that the media wasn't tip to stern controlled? And it's what's amazing is how vast their control over it is. But there has, because of that, and I think 9/11 really was sort of like the most dramatic wake-up event, you know, for people. Mm-hmm. Because of that, it spawned the alternative media. You know, if you look at the shows on Revolution Radio, you look at your shows, I mean, so many of them started really, you know, with that event and are related to that event. And so, the event may turn out to be the greatest liberating event that ever occurred because it totally exposed the media as fake, mm-hmm. you know, as basically a lifetime actor. You know, when you have, you know, Hannity and Wolf Blitzer, I mean, these aren't real people. These are actors.
Yeah.
These are basically people who are just trained in how to read text that is written for them and look believable. You know,
and what you're watching is a production. It's a show.
That's right. They're just characters. Who knows what they are? I mean, Sean Hannity comes out and he has an ash, you know, on his forehead on Wednesday, an Ash Wednesday. He's trying to make this representation that he's this about Catholic and this is, and so you give him trust. I mean, black propaganda, which was developed by Gregory Bateson, who then went on to found the CIA and then you know kind of organize the counterculture. You know, he said, look. In black propaganda, the one thing you have to have is trust. If you're going to damage them and give them something, you know, tell them a cultural truth, which is fake and it's damaging to them, they have to have some reason to believe what you say. So the persona has to be very carefully crafted. So when you look at, you know, Hannity or, you know, Wolf Blitzer or, yeah, whoever, Rush Limbaugh, I mean, Paul McCartney, right? I mean, these are very, very carefully crafted actor roles. And they are designed really just for the purpose of damaging culture, moving it in certain ways. The more we know about, and the more we use the expression lifetime actor, the better. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at Miley Cyrus, you know, parents will have such a hard time, you know, with 16-year-old girls trying to get them not to be influenced by this maniac. But if they have the understanding that this is a lifetime actor, then they can appeal to these young people with something that's really solid. They can say, look, you know, this person is just doing this, is just acting in this way to damage you. They want to move you into a debased world, and you have to find the strength inside yourself to resist this, you know. And there can be ways, once the concept of the lifetime actor is widely held, then people can develop, you know, techniques to resist against it and to support one another in not letting these people damage us.
Oh, don't bring them into your living room.
But for one thing, just turn them off.
Yeah, yeah.
That, yeah.
I mean, if you just cut off cable TV.
Absolutely. And that should be done.
Yeah.
I mean, look, it's weaponized anthropology. When people ask me that, I always say the same thing. Just unplug it. You even if you're a specialist, you will have a hard time not being damaged by it. There is almost nothing that is positive about it. And now that the internet has produced so many alternative and citizen participating media centers, then just use that.
Mm-hmm.
Use that. Try to learn it. Try to use it effectively. Try to use it unbiasedly and to get different perspectives. But use that and become more aggressive intellectually, you know, to try to don't just sit there and waste time when you're on the internet. Use it to you know, to get more and more information. Use it when you have important facts to find ways to you know, get friends, you know, to understand them. I mean, one really powerful thing now is all of these chains that are developed, you know, people that have you know, the different social networks and social media chains, where the person has, he posts something and it goes out to 100 people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's very dangerous for the oligarchs. I can see why they like those things, because they see them ultimately of being able to input directly into the minds of the citizen, you know,
yeah,
their interest. But right now it's a, you know, it's in a form where the citizen has a shot to actually control it. And so while we have it, we should be making really good advantage of it, you know, and just showing people, hey, you know, here's an analysis of Building 7's collapse. Here's a, you know, an analysis of, you know, Charlie Hebdo. You know, they have that, there's an amazing video in the Charlie Hebdo attack where a cop runs up and shoots someone in the ground with an AR round. And there's just a little tiny puff that hits the sidewalk. Well, I fired that weapon, and I can tell you, it would have, you know, in a real case, it would have just blown the sidewalk apart. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, these are really heavy rounds with tremendous velocity, and so, you know, that those kinds of things, these bedrock moments where the oligarchs slip up and the lifetime actors fail to deliver anything that's believable. Those are what we need to be, you know, sharing, because that's that first step into resistance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are go, okay, that can't be real. I understand there is a force in the government. It's controlling, you know, the media. It's controlling, you know, me. And with that, you know, then they can start to fight back. They mm-hmm. they'll have that first step.
And also, come and understand, when you're doing your research, these things, you start to. You will learn how these things get pulled off, how they can be pulled off, and why it isn't impractical.
Exactly.
Because you know the groups, you know, crisis actor agencies exist. There's outfits like Halo and Kraft International and Blackwater that do this stuff. And there's training. There's always these drills operating that are these kind of these multi-jurisdictional efforts that are headed by DHS or, you know, something. And so it's not too difficult to understand how it can get pulled off. Also, that just the history of media itself, whereas it's not as if the networks were infiltrated and taken over by the intelligence agencies. They were spawned from the intelligence agencies.
Exactly.
I mean, CBS, ABC, I mean, NBC. So, and I think it, well, even radio, I think Jan Irvin did a thing on the radio, Princeton Radio Project, back in the late 30s. And so,
right. And then, which ends up with, you know, Orson Welles.
Yeah.
You know, Freemason representation of, you know, War of the World, which is just terror. You know, It's like the zombie films that they put out today. I mean, this is a particular oligarchic humor, which has to do with their understanding of Christianity, but you don't need to get into that too much. You just need to know, why are all these zombie films? I mean, is there some insatiable appetite on the part of people to watch people getting their heads cut off? Look, the zombie films are ways to represent extreme violence against humans. If these were not zombies, you couldn't have, you know, hundreds of people with their heads chopped off, and in these violent and macabre ways, right, where they, you know, use egg beaters to take the brains out and things. But because they're, quote, zombies, then this is, you know, just standard human behavior. Well, what they're doing is they're training people to deal with sick and weak and hungry people as zombies. You see, this is just transparent neurolinguistic programming, which will come to effect in, you know, when you have a crisis and there's an epidemic, there's starvation, people need food, and rather than pulling together, everyone will see themselves as a zombie hunter and, you know, feel it's just fine to use an egg beater on their neighbor's brain. Mm-hmm. So this is why you just don't watch this crap.
Yeah, and same thing with the vampire meme.
Right, and you see, and also they the vampire films, and, you know, which creates a sense of unreality, but they're also terrifying. And that's the other thing, is that horror films are, you know, a way to keep people slightly frightened, and that's a great state for them to be in.
And you've mentioned other movies, like these survivor movies, right? These degraded.
Yeah, exactly. They've got this thousands of, well, hundreds of these survivor shows where, you know, like the most absurd one is Naked and Afraid, where they take two people who don't know each other, they take their clothes off, they put them in a primitive state, and then you just watch them, you know, basically try to eat grubs for 21 days. Well, what are they doing? I mean, they're just preparing people for a post-electric society. They're just normalizing where they want to take our culture. Mm-hmm. They're just preparing us. They're saying, and it's also native revivalism. They're saying, look, these people are having these great experiences. You know, they always, at the end of the show, they say, you know, it was tough, but I just had to make it. I had to make it to 21 days. And, you know, this is the greatest feeling I've ever had, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, this is normalizing this post-electric, Neanderthal type condition, because that's what they have in mind for us.
And breaking down inhibition.
And breaking, right. And breaking, you know, Naked and Afraid. But you see, this is exactly what they want. They want them as primitive as possible. I mean, if they could, they would even take away the capacity for speech.
You know? Well, didn't they? That's what John Dewey was all about, right?
Right. Well, I mean,
reading and whole language. Yeah.
Yeah. Dewey. I mean, this is just another. This was really well organized malfeasance. Yeah. Dewey, you know, he tried to get people to break away from phonetics, to phonetic decoding of our English, to a pictographic reading, whereby the word itself would be, you know, would have the meaning. Mm-hmm. Now, this was obviously malfeasance. I mean, pictographic languages, you know, like Chinese or Japanese, they have themes, so that a bird will have one representation, the word, then a raven will be a representation of that word plus a slight variation, and then eagle, et cetera, et cetera. So the brain doesn't have to memorize a different image for all of the set of birds, right? Mm-hmm. Pictographic language operates very, you know, very coherently in this fashion. Well, we are a phonetic language, right? There is no connection between eagle and raven, except that you can't see one being related to the other. They are only decodable in with phonetics. Mm-hmm. So Dewey's creation of whole language, you know, and of course he wrote about this. He, you know, slightly cryptic, but it's clear enough. It's just malfeasance. He's just trying to dumb down the population. He doesn't want them to read. He doesn't want the powerful American reader who existed in the grammar schools before he got to them. He wanted to take away that power that was threatening the oligarchs, and so Dewey came in and got rid of it. The
Well, a literate society is a thinking society, and thinking society aren't slaves.
Right. You know? Now, just to show connections, his granddaughter is Alice Dewey. She works at the University of Hawaii. She's an anthropologist. She'd worked with Gregory Bateson. Her premier student was Ann Durham. she wrote Durham's in Durham's book. It's Alice Dewey who writes the foreword. She praises Durham for the fight against modernism. In other words, Durham was part of this process which would go into these areas like Bali, parts of Indonesia, and then try to create an archaic revival or native revival with micro-lending so that they wouldn't make any progress. They would basically be paid to promote the crafts and culture of their ancestors. So Ann Durham, you know, was Alice Dewey's premier student. She, of course, had Barack Obama, our current president. But when you trace the malfeasance from John Dewey, and then look at Alice Dewey's foreword, where, you know, modernism, quote, you know, is being you know, attacked as a good idea, you know, that this is so, Ann Durham's doing such a wonderful thing. You can see this generational malfeasance, right? And you can see that. See, the thing about Obama, if you look at like this whole birth, I mean, you know, the birth certificate and, you know, all this stuff, that's the red herring. You know, that's why it's the story, is because they want to like talk about his father. What they don't want to talk about is his mother. You see, because now you're into the CIA, you're into the Alice Dewey's, you're into the organized malfeasance, and that's what they want to hide. So it's just a, you know, straightforward technique to, you know, to have the red herring to distract people from, you know, looking at what is, you know, you can actually see, and it's. You know, it's malfeasance, and that's what they try to hide.
And his meteoric rise is so obvious that it was engineered. If, you know, it's clear, the path is cleared for him.
Right. I mean, the thing is that he's a, and I have a friend of mine who is a black community activist who worked in Chicago. And he told me, he said, there is 100% certainty that in his mind that Obama is fake. He's a lifetime actor. He goes, this is how, he says, look, I know over 100 Chicago community activists. I've worked with them. I know them. There isn't one, there is not one that would have rather invaded Afghanistan than to put that $1 trillion into our community. Mm-hmm. There's not one of them. So he said, so Obama was somehow selected and trained, you know, years and years and years before, you know, his meteoric, you know, rise inside the American political sphere. So this is what we're up against. You know, they are, you know, they knew that a black face would be timely. They knew they could count on a certain constituency to vote for him automatically. Mm-hmm. They crafted his speeches, you know, he gave that speech when they suddenly he's giving this keynote speech at the Democratic convention. And he says, you know, I just realized that America had there was a place in America for, you know, a black kid with a funny last name, you know, and this language has all been carefully crafted to pull at the heartstrings of people. And he becomes an icon overnight. And then now he's president. And then people wonder why aren't the wars ending? You know, why is the surveillance state, you know, expanding? Why is wealth distribution, you know, now it's to the, you know, only the top 0.1%? How could this have happened under the presidential auspice of a black community activist? Well, it's because you have a lifetime actor, you see?
Yeah. And
that's how it could happen. That's why it happened.
Yeah, I imagine they have a stable of these people they can pull from.
Sure,
what are the political conditions?
Well, you know, it's like, you know, the way Freemasonry operates, which is one of the secret societies that's involved in all of this. I mean, they have an outer circles, you know, and they're inside that world. There is, you know, it just is what it is. It's not there's not malfeasance, but it's also blocked off from the inner world, the inner secrets. And in politics, it's the same way. There are probably, you know, quite a few Congress people and a few senators that are not inside the deal, but they're carefully controlled. The power is inside that. The congressional individuals are just there to camouflage the fact that there is a secret society that is malevolent and does not care about what these other people say. The higher level Freemasons don't care what the rank and file have in mind. The higher level political individuals, they don't care about low level congressmen or things like this. They are just there to confuse the public into believing that there is a real dialectic, that, you know, where, oh, gee, the things are bad, we have to elect a more aggressive congressperson or something.
Yeah.
They don't see that the structure, the political structure, is a dictatorship.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's the system of basically it's been the rule since the civilization began. It's an oligarchy. You know,
it's an oligarchy. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's, I mean, dictatorship is a single, but I mean, this is it's an oligarchy, and it's one that we don't know anything about these people.
And the oligarchs have never been have never left the arts alone. It's always been a tool for propaganda, for control, and it's the allegory of the cave, right?
It's why I started my research into Christianity, was trying to understand it as a basically how it resided within the political history. And, I wrote Caesar's Messiah, trying to, show people, well, this is really what the language of the Gospels means. And then I went into Shakespeare for that same purpose, is that the religion and the arts are basically the oligarch's toolbox. And they hurt us, they damage us, they keep us from developing real strength. And so the more we learn about them, the more we really understand how they're used and what they do, the better off we are. We need to take advantage of the internet, brother, because while it's here, we can exchange information. This is our opportunity. I do research, I do the best I can. One person can't possibly do everything, and all of us can barely do everything when we work together. But we can, by keeping ourselves connected and by sharing information we think is important, we can break away from the effects of the mainstream media, mm-hmm. from the propaganda. And I think we can, very quickly have a much clearer mind, mm-hmm. generally.
Maintain your critical thought, maintain those faculties, and the first step of that is turning off the TV set, get free of the flickering.
Jan Erwin makes the case of trying to train yourself, he calls it the trivium, but I would just say formal logic. I mean, learn the fallacies. Learn how to defend yourself from the intellectual assaults. Because they're so often, they're just obvious fallacy. 911, some of the explanations just absurd. So if you're good at that, that's good. But then you also have to defend yourself against neuro-linguistic programming, because you have ill logic, which can be used against you. But there's also Miley Cyrus, that's the you have to understand the culture is a weapon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the mind control is the Disney Channel. It doesn't necessarily have to be a evil scientist working for CIA. It's it can be the Disney Channel.
Yeah, I mean, just turn the damn thing off. Look, yeah. Hannah Montana. I mean, Miley Cyrus is just one of these really important people to understand. Really important, because it's so clear. You see, you can see how they shaped her first character, Hannah Montana, mm-hmm. how Hannah has this alter ego, right?
Yeah.
All of this is setting up the young girls who are watching the show to identify with Hannah, with her exotic and happy and interesting life, all of her boyfriends and her intrigues, and you identify with her. And then when she makes a transition to this rock star and becomes literally the whore of Babylon, it's just clearly a program. I mean, this is just a someone has sat there and worked out the details of her career, and to damage people, young women, in the greatest degree possible. So that's pretty clear. You know, that's when you look at it in context, it's pretty clear. And so that's, yeah, Miley Cyrus, very important person to understand, because then you don't have any trouble turning off the Disney Channel. You see, once you see Miley Cyrus clearly, then you say, okay, well, then this is crazy. I cannot let this in my house. Mm-hmm. And that's really an important step. Just turn off cable TV. Turn it off. It's a, you know, tip to stern, weaponized anthropology. Don't go to any of the movies. The mainstream movies are virtually all just weaponized anthropology. So, you know, start. We have to basically recreate media, and recreate news. Recreate.
Well, you find if you're not watching this stuff, you might spend more time reading, learning the language. And the more you learn to command, the better command you get of the English language you get through reading, the better thought process you have. Right?
You got it, brother. Yeah. I mean, that's well said. You absolutely. Know. You know, so.
So, well, listen, I have you a long time, but I'm going to let you go.
Hey, Tim, it has been a real pleasure. And I just, you know, one last thing. I just want to thank you for your show. It's really righteous, brother. And keep up the good work.
I want to thank you for, you know, spending so much time with me tonight.
That's a pleasure.
And, you know, I'd like to have you back again sometime.
Anytime, I'm always available. And really, any way I can support you, I will.
Okay, thank you. And and again, your stuff is
If you want to look at the books, go to caesarsmessiah.com. Okay. You can buy my books. My books are also available at postflaviana.org. I answer questions about Christianity and Shakespeare at caesarsmessiah.com, and at postflaviana.org I take on the modern stuff, you know, the Beatles and MKUltra and stuff like that. Monday morning on Revolution Radio, Dr. Jerry Russell and I do a show called The Secret Society Revealed, and we take callers in case anybody's interested. Always happy to talk.
That's usually about 2 hours, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so yeah, you cover a lot of ground on those talks. Great. Well, listen, thank you. And listen, I wish you a happy new year.
Okay, you too, Tim.
We'll talk again in the new year. Right. Thanks.
Yeah, hope to. Bye-bye.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.